When Nero was singing, no one was allowed to leave the theater, even in an emergency. Some women therefore gave birth during his performances, and many people, weary with listening and applauding, secretly jumped over the wall or pretended to be dead and were carried out to be buried. That's just one of many accounts revealing the underside of ancient Rome. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Although the Romans are mostly known for their amazing military and urban accomplishments and their development of laws and language, they also had a flair for fantasy and vulgarity. A look into the customs and superstitions of ancient Rome reveals many curiosities. For example, Roman authors argue that dreaming of books can mean sudden death for anyone not a teacher, or that dreaming of being dead can foretell marriage for a bachelor. These are but a few of the examples included in a new book from Oxford University Press entitled A Cabinet of Roman Curiosities, Strange Tales and Surprising Facts from the World's Greatest Empire. Joining us is its author, UW Professor of Classics, James McEwen.
Welcome back to University of the Air. It's been a very long time since you talked to us about Ovid, Roman love poet.
I'm very glad to be here.
Well, if I remember my dates correctly, let's see, ancient Rome, 753 BC to 476 AD. That's a long time for a group of people, a population as wild and strange as these people to hold forth. What sort of departure point did you have for finding all these strange stories about ancient Rome?
Well, actually, I didn't consciously set out to find these things. Some of them are just things that any classicist will know, however bizarre they are and how little they can actually do with this sort of information. And others are things that caught my eye over very many years as I was just reading through Latin and also Greek texts. For years, I didn't do anything with it except, I suppose, go off at tangents during lectures and in classes and regale the students with whatever it was that I had come across over the last few days. Then I actually have just published a textbook for Latin for first-year students. And it has a website. And on the website, some of these little snippets of information appear. And they're there as a kind of a bonus, a reward for the students for going through the exercises. Exercises in learning Latin, Amoa Massa Mat, and so on.
Yes.
They're utterly, utterly fascinating. But you can believe that if you like. It's something that has to be done, and it's always nice to get a little bit of sugar on the pill.
Well, I remember from my years as a Latin scholar back in eighth grade and then later in high school that there was an awfully lot of salt, even in the most basic text. There were words that were sort of bolderized, you know, by Mrs. Sweeney and who was very proper. And there's also a story that the glossaries of the books used to have all of the dirty words at the back, which is the first place all those boys would go to look for, you know, spicing up their vocabulary. I mean, the Romans, were they as spicy as all those books, writings would imply?
Well, as I was coming in today, I was kind of hoping you wouldn't ask me about this because I mean, I don't know to whom I'm talking here. I mean, I know I'm talking to you two, but beyond that, I'm not sure. And it certainly is true that the Roman literature, both prose and poetry, does, in certain instances, have a degree of obscenity that we would not be expecting to find nowadays. But it was part of their culture, and you can't really argue with it. They were just different from us. I will say, I know exactly what you're talking about when you say that the poetry was bowdlerized. It reduced it to pretty well gibberish because if you take away...
It was just too much, huh?
Yeah, if you take away the obscenity, you may well find yourself with very little left. The poetry that I particularly work on, Ovid's erotic poetry, in the last book of his Amores, he has a poem, 3-7, which is about his impotence. And in the 19th century, I very earnest scholar, a German as it happened, took out all the lines which he didn't think Ovid could have written, by which he really meant all the lines which he wished Ovid hadn't written. The poem has 84 lines, but when he had finished with it, it had 38. So
that's quite a reduction.
Quite a reduction.
You have as the title of your book A Cabinet of Roman Curiosities and then Strange Tales and Surprising Facts. That suggests you've got a sort of mixture of fiction and fact. And as you were assembling this book, how did you decide what to include in terms of its actual, you know, whether it was true or not?
If I'd left out anything that I wasn't confident about as regards its being true, I think we might have had a little pamphlet on our hands. I would like to say emphatically that I take no responsibility for any of the things which appear in the book. They have been culled from literature, mostly literature, but there are some inscriptions and things like that, simply because they're there. And it's for any reader, just as well as myself, to make up their own mind about why it's there.
Well, let's start with the one I opened with, the one where it says when Nero was singing, no one was allowed to leave the theater, even in an emergency, and some women gave birth during the performance. Other people jumped over the wall or pretended to be dead. Where does an account like that, where did you find it, and how do we know if that is really true?
As far as I remember, that comes only in the biography of Nero by Suetonius. Suetonius did have access to the archives, but probably not for a period as late as Nero. He was writing a couple of generations after Nero was on the throne. But that may or may not be true. I think, for what it's worth, which it may or may not be anything, I think it probably is. Nero had a reputation for being very
hard to get along with.
Well, he was certainly hard to get along with, but he had a very high opinion of himself as a performer and as a poet. Once he was asked how long an epic that he was considering writing, but never did, it was going to be, and he thought it was suggested to him that it should be in 400 books. Well, the longest poem in Latin has, to give you an idea, and that one has 15 books. But then one of the other courtiers said, well, if it's that long, nobody is going to read it. And he was sent into exile. But he probably did keep people in the theatre and didn't let them out. There may be a little bit of an exaggeration there in the same sort of way. One of the things that one of his predecessors was supposed to have done, Caligula, who did an awful lot of very bad things in the 4 years that he was emperor. But it is said that he wanted a horse from the chariot stable that he supported to be consul of Rome. This may have been a joke, but we have it embedded as one of the things which was recorded as an instance of his lunacy.
Some of the stories, some of the tales in here seem to go way back or surprise me when I encounter them, including it seemed as if there was an ancient Roman equivalent of the chicken and the egg, which came first.
That story, yes, told in Macrobius, who's relatively late. But since the book went to the press, I discovered that the Greeks had it before them, several hundred years before that. And in fact, a story that's not in the book, the Romans didn't know much about the far north, but they did know that it was very, very cold. And they said the people who lived beyond the north wind, when they had conversations in the winter, because it was so cold, the words froze and they didn't find out what the other was saying until the spring came. Well, now, I didn't find that in time to put it in the book. It's in a Greek source anyway, but it is a Greek from the Roman period. But I remember saying that in comics when I was, well, it wasn't 2,000 years ago, but, you know, much more recently. So a pretty, pretty feeble, these jokes. There is actually a Greek joke book, which is from the Roman period, and it features quite a lot in the book. But some jokes are timeless.
So what are some of these incidents, what are some of these curiosities tell us, for example, about Roman family life? I noticed you started with that category. And if we're looking at things that are a little off-kilter, what sort of view do we get of Roman family life?
Well, I was not setting out to give a complete view of anything, in fact, in the book. It was just things which maybe struck me as amusing or distracting in some way, and that I hoped it would be the same with others. Though you will realise this has been through the mill with, for example, my wife, who has swept aside quite a number of stories which she has told me that only someone as pedantic as I am could possibly be interested in them. But, well, it occurred to me that it might be interesting to learn that it's possible for a marriage to be arranged even if the couple are not present, as long as they agree to it at a later stage. I mean, that can tell you quite a lot about Roman society, that it will be the parents who will make the arrangements and the children will just have to go along with it, because it's all part of the way of probably keeping inheritance within the family. But I don't make any comments like that for... I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a historian, but that looks a safe inference.
You get the impression, though, that it really didn't matter too much who a person was married to, because there seem to be so many stories that imply that it was just a sort of standard operating procedure for women to have lovers, for men to have lovers, serial lovers, and in fact, in some instances that you were not considered really up to snuff unless you had a stable of lovers.
That might well be true, but if, again, you're drawing me into talk, you know, making judgments on the statements that are here, but one can see that the idea that a woman is a bit odd if she doesn't have at least two lovers, that comes from a Stoic philosopher who's likely to say that sort of thing, not just about women, but about anyone that's maybe not living a calm, what he would regard as moral life. It comes from Seneca, but Seneca is a great moralist. He was very influential, but he also precipitated the revolt of Boadicea, it is said, by drawing in a debt that the various people in, various rich people in Britain had, and they couldn't pay it. So they revolted. That's, I believe, one of the reasons, apart from the violence that was perpetrated against the British.
First century
in
AD.
In the first century AD. But he is always talking about the simple life, but he is well known as being the richest man in the Roman Empire. So you're looking at two different
Say
ways.
Say one thing, yeah, live yeah, another yeah. thing.
Reading yeah. your second section, which was called Women, you know, I should say that this sort of miscellany of a book is organized in little units. So we have family life, women, names, education, the army, and so on. In your section called Women, the overall impression I came away with is that there certainly was a double standard for men and women.
Again, we're discussing the sources in a more serious way than I would be intending it. I could only work with what I got from this, and there are almost no women who have written anything that has come down to us from Greece or Rome, and it is all very definitely prejudiced against them.
Can you give us a few samples from your section on women?
Well, it catches my eye. It's sitting, the book's sitting open here. I see that women were not allowed to sit in the theatre with men. They had to sit in the back rows. There was segregation like that.
But I guess at the sporting events, it was not true. In some instances, they didn't have to sit
that's,
in the back.
In the theatre, in case a performance of a Greek tragedy got too exciting for them, but they could sit for a gladiatorial spectacle. They could sit wherever they could get much closer than that.
Well, you know, if you're going to have them giving birth during a play, you probably want them toward the back anyway.
quite.
You also include a lot of tidbits just having to do with sort of daily life, you know, cosmetics, hair loss.
Spectacular cosmetics in there with mouse droppings and ground-up mouse heads.
There is a story in there that Cleopatra, the famous Cleopatra the Seventh of Egypt, the last of the Ptolemies, that she had written a book on cosmetics. But that's the attraction to a great name of something a bit more banal. But yes, mouse droppings were apparently one of the ingredients that were needed in some beauty potion.
Probably not so different from what's in some of those things today, if the truth were known.
No comment.
Well, give us another category. I sort of feel as if we're looking at this box of precious and semi-precious stones, little odds and ends, and maybe an occasional old coin in there. So pull some more out and tell us some of the things that strike you as particularly memorable.
The ones that attract me mostly are stories where I think, well, how did that ever happen? One of my favorite stories is about a chap who didn't get on with his neighbor, and so he invited him away for a couple of days, and on the first day he demolished this chap's home. The next day he built it again, but he built it on a bigger scale, but exactly as it had been.
Why?
Exactly. The chap, he then, having done this, he said to him, look, you can see from this, one, I have the power to destroy you, and two, I have the power to help you if you're my friend. He was a courtier with one of the early emperors, the chappie who did this. But I just like to think of the situation where the chap goes back home and everything's the same, but it's entirely different. I mean, it's just such a comic situation to imagine.
Well, I suppose if we're trying to extend some of this into our own lives, and we all have neighbors, and, you know, maybe there are things that irritate us or whatever, but you just imagine that incredible show of chutzpah or whatever, the show of power that you could do that.
I think I'd better say no comment, for I have never.
Well, I mean, I guess what strikes me is we're looking at things from so long ago, yet let's say if it's Cleopatra and she's putting mouse droppings to try to prevent hair loss, and it reminds us of what lengths we'll go to try to, you know, restore our youth or our beauty. And then, you know, many of the things, even if they seem bizarre and eccentric and odd, they still come from the same human desire or failing or foible.
Yes, that's certainly true. You mentioned about the hair loss, some potion or ointment for that. When one looks at ancient medicine, some of the ingredients that are used there are so disgusting, is the only word. This is disgusting, but without being actually a medicine. It was thought that if you put goat dung in a hyperactive child's diaper, it would stop them being hyperactive.
The more so if it was a girl.
The more so if it was a girl. I mean, just let's just refine it even more. Where do you come by that?
Think of the experiments required to come to that conclusion.
How would it occur to, how do you get from not knowing that that works to thinking that it does? Why goats? But that's the way it is.
What were some of the other, I'll call them, superstitions that you came across?
One of the things that struck me was just how superstitious people were. Even the people who ran the government were very taken with what we would call superstition, but they would call religion. There's a story that one of the great families, the Sir William Brutus, the chap who killed Julius Caesar, his mother was a Sir William. So these are very powerful people. They apparently, I should be saying apparently to every single item here, but you get the idea. They apparently had a bronze coin, and in a ceremony every year, they fed it silver coins and gold coins. And if it ate them, the Sir Willie were going to thrive and get consulships and governorships of provinces and what have you. And if the coin, I suppose, got a bit scrawny, it meant they weren't going to have such a good year. Where does that come from? That is so odd. But these are the chaps who were running the world, essentially the whole Mediterranean basin was in the hands of these people.
You find leaders in recent history who consulted astrology and other things. So it still is not that far removed from today.
Yes, actually, when you say astrology, Norman, you mentioned at the beginning that Rome was founded in 753 BC on April the 21st as well. How do we know that? We know that because in the first century BC, an astrologer looked at the life of Romulus, who achieved this, that and the other and founded Rome and whatever. But he looked at the deeds in his life and he worked back. Instead of being an astrologer who predicts things, he's already did. And then he worked back to the time at which he must have been born and all his life from then on, including the foundation.
There's that famous picture you have, too, of the she-wolf suckling mm-hmm. Romulus and Remus, but that apparently isn't exactly what it looked like originally.
No, the she-wolf was there. I think there are even scholars who won't believe that this magnificent statue of the she-wolf isn't, I think it's 5th century BC.
It's Etruscan, actually.
It's really quite an icon. But the twins were put there in the Renaissance. In more recent times, this is not the sort of thing which appears often in the book, but the book has no brief to talk about. It wasn't going anywhere, so I did add this in. I think someone told me that in Rome, Georgia, they have a copy of this statue. It was given by Mussolini in the 1930s. But when there were meetings in the town hall where it was placed, they used to cover the she-wolf because it has quite conspicuous udders and it's bowdlerizing. And they actually put diapers
on Romulus
and Remus.
Well, they're being suckled after all, you know. They realistically have been wearing
it's a bit daft is the only word for that.
We'll hope the diapers didn't have goat dung. More on the curiosities of ancient Rome when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. If one wishes a child to be born with black eyes, the mother should eat a shrew during her pregnancy. That's a bit of advice from Pliny's Natural History, included in the book A Cabinet of Roman Curiosities. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is James McEwen, and we're talking about some very odd bits of information gathered into this miscellany. That one happened to be in a section called Medicine. You draw on Pliny's Natural History quite a bit. His book is, in a way, a little bit like yours, isn't it, in the sense of all kinds of fantastical and factual things mixed together?
It is, in a way, in as much as you can read Pliny again and again, as I suppose I do, and every time you read it, you find something that you kind of missed the time before. But he didn't set out to write anything that was curious. He wasn't collecting curiosities. He thought that he was writing the truth about everything, or at least that he may say, I don't believe this, but it is said, so I'd better tell you this. But Pliny had a very important influence for 1,000 years and more as a repository of ancient knowledge, as much Greek, more Greek than Roman, actually. But on the other hand, you do wonder a bit. Can I just mm-hmm. mention a few things that you find in Pliny? Pliny says that you have to be careful when your ships are at anchor that mermen, you know, like male mermaids, that they don't come and sit on your boat because they weigh quite a bit and they could actually sink it. And he says he has this on authority of some Roman officers that this can happen. And you wonder why he's saying that when he died, he was actually the admiral of the Roman fleet. He was a really active politician, a courtier, a military leader. He wasn't somebody who was just living in an ivory tower with no real notion of what went on in the world. But he thought that maybe you have to be careful about mermen. So,
you know, it almost sounds like Gaelic humor to me, doesn't it? I mean, it's said with a straight face, but you almost suspect, don't you, that he's pulling your leg?
Sometimes I am sure our leg is being pulled. In fact, there is another text which I keep referring to because it is so, it would be wrong of me not to have referred to it, the thing called the Historia Augusta. These are biographies of the later emperors, mostly periods which we can be grateful we've got this because it's about all we've got about some of them. But you wonder how seriously they're writing. For example, when we're told about the tallest Roman emperor. Now, the tallest Romans weren't actually all that tall, but the tallest Roman emperor would really have stood out because we are told that he was 8'6".
So he would have stood out.
By Roman calculations, that would be only a wee bit more than 8 feet because their feet were smaller than ours. But you can see I'm trying to temper it a bit. Yeah. But you can't do too much with that. And there are pages and pages of this stuff can be gathered out of this. But some people think that this was written seriously. But,
some of the information seems to be what we would nowadays call old wives' tales. Like that if you kiss a mule on the lips, it can cure hiccups?
Well, actually...
what, you've tried it or...
Well...
It cures the mule's hiccups.
That might well be an old wives' tale. There are plenty more that I think I would agree with. But since I am commenting on the content of the book, not just saying, here it is, you make up your own mind, I actually think that if you kiss a she-mule on the nostrils, it might well cure hiccups because I know an old wives' tale, which it was a German friend who told me this, that if you think of three bald men, your hiccups will be cured. Well, why should that be so? But I do it. Because I'm bald myself, I have to think of four. But by the time I've thought of four, my hiccups usually have stopped.
Does Julius Caesar count as one?
Julius Caesar would be offended if you said that because Julius Caesar said that the thing which he most valued of all the honors that were paid to him by the Senate was that he was allowed to wear a laurel wreath all the time because that hid the fact that we can see this in the iconography. He went in quite a lot for comb over.
I remember the phrase Capito Calvo, right? bald head referred to Caesar.
He was indeed. Caesar was certainly the most interesting Roman there was. The thing about Caesar which I find most attractive is that he was capable of riding a horse at a gallop with his hands behind his back. Now, we don't think of that as being maybe, you know, there's probably, probably in Madison there's 100 people can do that.
I doubt it.
But they have stirrups and he didn't. I have horses, so that's why I think of this. I know that for me to get to a trot with stirrups is hard enough. But Julius Caesar ruled the Roman world, and yet he was capable of doing this. If you want to extend it to modern politicians, can we pick one we think might be able to do this? Probably few enough of them. But if we did this, there would be a lot of things that they did that we can't match. Can I maybe mention the swearing in of the commander-in-chief for the Roman army, or rather the dictator who was a dictator is not a bad word. It just means the man who has single control of the army and the state for a very limited period. Once they were having a crisis in the late 3rd century BC, and while they were going through the rituals of swearing this dictator in, he heard a shrew squeak. This was regarded as a bad omen. Therefore, he said, I'm sorry, I cannot take this office. So he backed out and had to find, in this crisis in the state, they had to find somebody else to do it. Well, would that happen? Is that how we appoint senior military officers? Probably not.
Well, if it's an account like the one of Caesar writing with his hands behind his back, is that backed up in enough sources or is it one sort of biographer who's sort of doing almost more of a hagiography where it's, you know, exaggerating, making Caesar out to be more than he was?
An awful lot of the stories have just one authority, one source. But that's true of anything really from antiquity because what we know is really so tenuous. We have lost, it doesn't bear thinking what we have lost from antiquity. So we often have to just accept it and have no context, no wider context in which to judge it.
You have a story about, I think, the Republican era in Rome, and the city having an anagram of its name that was kept secret. It never occurred to me, Roma versus Amor.
Yes, Roma and Amor. And apparently there is a story told, and it's in a late Greek source, that someone gave out the real name of Rome, which was the palindrome then, Amor. And he was crucified for doing so. If you want to know more about that, well, I'm afraid you'll have to ask somebody else. That's typical of just a little snippet. But the name of Rome couldn't have been better chosen, because when the Romans were fighting the Greeks, and the Greeks found they were facing Roma, this was a very advantageous piece of propaganda for the Romans, because Rome in Greek, the equivalent, means power and strength. So the Greeks were facing a powerful enemy, as indeed they were. The Greeks were not able to put up too much resistance against the Romans.
There were quite a few times when I was reading through your book where I saw links to words we use today, like plumbing or vendetta. I mean, maybe you can give us a few examples of how, when you're looking at these little odds and ends in stories, you sometimes find the origin of a word we're using every day.
Well, plumbing is good, because the Romans, plumbum, PB, I think, appears in
periodic tables. Yeah.
Yes, but PB is plumbum, is lead. The Romans used lead for their plumbing, and hence that's our word. Though they knew that lead was not good for the taste of water, they don't think they knew that it could cause the damage to health.
It could actually make you go mad.
Yes, but they didn't use it as much as we might think they do. But my favorite etymology there, the derivation there, is our word muscle, which means the Latin word for a mouse is mus, and the Latin word for a wee mouse is musculus. And the Romans thought that when you flex your upper arm, well, we can't do this in the radio, and it wouldn't work on my arm anyway, you see a wee mouse running up and down. So slightly fanciful, but our word muscle is the same as wee mouse.
Parting shot?
Parting shot.
It's a fascinating little story.
The parting shot will originally have been Parthian shot, because the Romans, their great enemy in the east, were the Parthians, and their main fighting mode was to shoot. They used archery was their main mode, and I don't know how this would work more than once, but what they would do is they would pretend to run away, gallop away on their horses, and then the enemy, the Romans say, would come after them, and this would break up their line, and then as they were going away, the Parthians would shoot at them backwards.
Parting shots.
Parting shots. I always thought, you know, if I were on a horse trying to shoot a bow and arrow, probably I would feel happy enough if I could manage, you know, about one a minute.
But that would hit the mark.
I have actually seen a Hungarian managing 10 in 17 seconds. So these chaps, it must have been utterly devastating. There is only one battle in antiquity, apparently, which was won by archery at the Battle of Carrhae, when the Romans had apparently 30,000 troops, 10,000 got away, 10,000 were killed, and 10,000 were made captive. And it looks as if they may well have been shipped east and sold to the Chinese, which is really quite fantastic, because the Romans knew nothing about the Chinese. There was little contact ever, but until the second century, there's pretty well none.
Don't know if it's in your book or not, but how about that word testify?
Testify. Well, it's not in the book, but testify is okay as a word. Testimonium is actually a Latin word. It was etymologized as being the same as testes. And testes was, well, it could be a medical word, but it was not used politely except when it meant a witness. But you needed to have testicles to give evidence in court. So it was said, though I do not actually have an ancient authority that I can quote on that one. It may be there, but I have never looked it out.
You have a tale about pirates and pigs. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, well, that's thank you for asking me that, because this is more just an endearing little tale that the ancient Mediterranean was overrun, infested with pirates. There's a wee story that pirates rustled a herd or a flock of pigs, and they took them back to their ship and off they went. And just before they got out of earshot, the pigmen who were looking after them, who of course would not come anywhere near the pirates, they called their pigs, and the pigs all ran to one side of the ship because they were now expecting their dinner. The ship sank. The pirates, who were all armored and what have you, drowned, and the pigs swam safely to shore. I actually did a little bit of research on that because I didn't think that pigs could swim, but pigs are apparently really quite good swimmers.
The rest of the story, it sounds a little bit like a tall tale. Julius Caesar was captured by pirates.
Julius Caesar was captured by pirates, and we do have good authority for this. He was taken to the pirates' lair, and the pirates sent off to get a ransom for him, and Julius Caesar felt insulted by the amount they'd asked for, and he asked for it to be increased very substantially. And then he was with the pirates for, I don't know, about a month, and he apparently got on very well with them. And every day he would say, well, of course, he was going to get a troop of soldiers together and come back and crucify them. And they all thought this was wonderfully funny. But when he was ransomed, he got a troop of soldiers together, he came back, and he did crucify them. But some of the versions that tell us the story say that he felt kindly enough to them that he had their throats cut before they were crucified.
That is one thing that runs through the book is a lot of barbarity in terms of punishments and, you know, public executions, body parts being cut off, terrible massacres. There's a lot of violence.
I think that we would find Roman society utterly alien in this way. But I'm being drawn into talking about, you know, to interpreting it. But yes, there was. If you think about even something like a big public sacrifice, if you have 300 oxen being sacrificed to some deity, well, where's the blood? It's all over the place. The stench, the flies must have been awful. And that's just something they're deliberately doing and everybody's happy about because they're going to get meat from that. There's a little story about how sometimes oxen escape and run through the streets after their heart has been ripped out. Or I can't imagine it's quite, they can have quite that little of them left. But you can envisage it's something that we don't really see. But yes, Roman society and Greek, any ancient society did tend to be pretty vigorous in punishments. That's for sure.
Find out a little bit about those Vestal Virgins when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest is James McCune, and he's telling us about some remarkable curiosities of ancient Rome. As long as I mention those Vestal Virgins, I am curious as to what were they guarding and what was the penalty if they lost their status?
Well, Vestal Virgins, their main purpose was to guard the sacred flame of Vesta, the goddess of the hearth, this flame that was supposed to have been brought from Troy. The thing that most people know about them is that the virgins had to be virgin, and if they weren't, the penalty was extremely severe. They were buried alive. The reason they were buried alive and not killed, executed in some way, is that their person was sacred. So the Romans got round this. They were very good with finessing their laws. An underground pit was dug and she was put in it with a wee bit of food and water, I think a lamp, and left to her own devices. It was covered over. And so...
That's horrible. It's horrible.
The man
horrible.
In the story didn't do too well either.
No, the man would be flogged to death with, I think, blood-coloured sticks. So, yes, he had the better of it for at least it was a wee bit quicker. But it tended to be that Vestal Virgins were found to be unchaste rather more often in times of great national crisis. So it obviously was, and I'm interpreting here again, that this was something that was used as a kind of a scapegoat in society. But it was pretty awful.
You have a section of your book called Foreigners, too, and that's interesting, just looking at the way ancient Romans regarded others.
Well, the Romans had... actually, can I read a nice little story about the Gauls? This is from Ammianus Marcellinus, who's a late historian and a very reliable chap, but he does have a satirical touch to him. The Romans were always a bit intimidated by their northern adversaries, the Gauls in particular, the people from France and Belgium, Britain, and the Germans, because they were so big and the Romans were small. But as Julius Caesar says, you know, we may be small, but we seem always to win. But even so.
A little understatement
yeah,
there.
Now, the Gauls were also known as Celts. I'll just read what he says. He says, "The Celts are almost all very tall and fair-skinned with reddish hair. Their eyes are intimidatingly fierce, they love quarrelling and are overbearingly arrogant. Indeed, a whole band of foreigners could not match any one of them in a brawl if he should call on his grey-eyed wife to help him, for she's far stronger than he is. She's especially hard to face when she swells her neck, grinds her teeth, swings her massive snow-white forearms and begins to kick and throw punches like bolts shot from the taut strings of a catapult." It sounds as if he's seen it.
But it's the wife that he's
the, it's the
with.
Wife that's more redoubtable adversary than the Gaul himself.
What would you say, if you think of your whole book, what would you say would be the fears of the Romans? If you look at what are they afraid of? You know, if you're looking at nightmares or various things that they would do to ward off something bad, do you get a sense of what scared them?
It's very hard to get a coherent picture because, take for example, the afterlife. They didn't know whether there was one. I mean, some said yes, some didn't. It's all a bit inconsistent in that regard. But to show you the intimidation they felt, they always thought it was better to be safe than sorry. So they had a goddess called Farina, and nobody knew who she was. They'd always had her. And every year on a day in June, I think it was, they celebrated a festival in her honour.
Just in case.
Just
in case. They didn't
want
to get her riled.
They, you know, just it's better to do this than just to drop her from the state religion.
As long as we have touched on the Roman military, what kind of stories do we have from army life?
Since I've told a story in favour, I would say, of women in saying that they are better in a fight than the men are, even amongst the Celts, maybe I could say that the Romans, every night when they were stopping on their march, they built a camp. And it was always the same way, so they would always know exactly where they were if they were attacked. But if they were ever forced to set up a camp in a disadvantageous position, they called it a stepmother. So, we don't know much about military slang. Most of the words that the language that we have from the Romans, it tends to be coming from pretty polished authors, not the man in the street.
Again, Caesar most prominently.
He would be for military stuff, yes. His is pretty refined.
You have a section of your book about food as well, all kinds of things with truffles and eels and oysters and I don't know what all. Can you give us some sense of
Italian
of
food?
Well, actually, yes, there is a story about a chap who bit into a truffle and broke his tooth because there was a coin embedded in it. The truffle had grown around the coin. Well, that's fair enough, but it occurs to me that nobody nowadays is in much danger of that happening to them. I mean, we don't eat truffles the way they do. I think most of us would find... I mean, I certainly haven't, but I suspect they would be a taste that would be pretty hard to acquire.
What about other things having to do with food and food preparation?
Well,
or just the things they ate.
There was a great variety in terms of what people would eat. Apparently, 90% of the bones that are discovered have got some sort of malnutrition evident in them. People subsisted on really rather little. But we, of course, hear about the fantastic, the decadent. There's a recipe that I've given for how to cook a flamingo. Well, most people went year after year without getting a taste of flamingo. The recipe itself isn't particularly exciting as far as I don't know anything about cooking, but it's what one might expect. And it does say if you're tired of flamingo, you could try the same recipe for parrots, but which would be really exotic.
And of course, it might talk back before you ate.
I keep picturing a book from our own time, about our own time, written later, where it would put all kinds of celebrity gossip, National Enquirer kinds of stuff, and odds and ends. I mean, it would be fairly easy with American society, I would think, to pull some outlandish tales and odd bits that show human behavior at its extremes.
I'm sure it would. But as I say, I don't feel that I have anything more to do in this book than just say, here is what they said, make your own mind up about it. Out of context, of course, some of these things will look more bizarre than maybe they are. But I tried to be fair and not to pick something that was just absolutely outrageous just for its own sake.
So, Jim, how did the Romans come to believe some of these things about animals, which clearly could be verified as untrue?
The bizarre thing about some of these things is that they are so patently not true, and yet they are repeated in author after author. I mean, the most obvious one would probably be the notion that goats, unlike other mammals, I mean, it's put in quite a technical way, goats, unlike all other mammals, breathe through their ears. Well, I mean, the goat was a basic staple item, whether it's on the table or just in the field. That beggars belief, but it's said. I mean, there's something that's maybe not as obvious would be, and I like this wee story, that if tuna fishermen are out in their boat, they have a chap up looking for a shoal or a school of the fish, and his job is to count the fish that he can see, because he knows exactly from his calculation there of how many there are that he can see. He knows how many there will be in the shoal, because as everybody knows, tuna always swim in a very tightly grouped school. They make a solid cube with all of them facing outwards as they swim along. So there are as many tuna down and deep as there are that you can see on the top. I don't think my math was very good there. It's a cube of tuna, but it doesn't take any thought to realize that none of them can swim sideways or backwards.
Right.
But that was
they bought it.
That was the belief.
So do you think, just like Pliny thinking there were mermen, it's just that maybe they wanted to think something fantastical and imaginative? I mean, is that what you think? Is it just shows the power of the human imagination?
Well, that's
it'd be nice if tuna
that's
fish
the
were
point,
in a cube.
That's the kind of the point of the book, that it's there. You know, you have to make your own mind up about it.
Well, we'll try to do that. We might lose some sleep over whether those tuna really did swim in a cube, and if they didn't, why the Romans thought so. But it's all fascinating, charming, and thought-provoking. And thanks for being with us for this hour, James McKeown.
Thank you very much for having me here.
We've been looking at Roman curiosities, a cabinet of Roman curiosities. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Well, we have a little time left over. Let's look directly at some of these nuggets that our guest today, Jim McKeown, has put in his book, A Cabinet of Roman Curiosities.
Well, here's a few from the section called Medicine, and these are coming from Pliny's Natural History. We already talked about the one where if you touch the nostrils of a she-mule with one's lips, it's said to stop sneezing and hiccups. And here are a few more. Sexual intercourse is good for lower back pain, for weakness of the eyes, for derangement, and for depression. If a person whispers in a donkey's ear that he has been stung by a scorpion, the affliction is immediately transferred to the donkey. And a last one here. Strains and bruises are treated with wild boar's dung gathered in spring and dried. This treatment is used for those who have been dragged by a chariot or mangled by its wheels or bruised in any way. Fresh dung also may be smeared on.
Well, here's one that sounds a little bit more fun from the food and drink department of the book. It's a game that involved flicking wine from one's cup at a target. It was apparently inordinately popular in Greece, but seems not to have caught on quite so much in Rome. Nonetheless, banquets could be messy affairs. We're told, for example, that it's a good idea to construct a dining room with drains and charcoal paving to soak up wine poured or spat out. And such a pavement also prevented barefoot slaves from catching cold. There's a benefit you wouldn't have thought of.
Well, and here's a few from the section on women. Our ancestors wanted all women to be under the control of guardians because of their feeble powers of judgment, said Cicero. The supposed inferiority of women is not a peculiarly Roman prejudice. It was, if anything, even more entrenched among the Greeks. Aristotle, for example, says, a woman is a kind of imperfect man, and it's through a disability that the female is female.
Well, I'm going to remain in the food and drink section for a minute for this note about Alaric the Visigoth. He was paid off with gold, silver, silk, and 3,000 pounds of pepper as his price for not plundering Rome in the early 5th century, since the Visigoths were said to cook their meat by riding around with it between their saddle cloth and their horse's back. That pepper would have been particularly welcome.
Here's another one from the women section. Livy reports that about 170 women from leading families were convicted in 331 BC of poisoning their husbands. Other sources give even larger numbers.
Well, one of our country's big mottos may well have come from a cookbook, which reads like this. His hand goes round in a circle. Gradually, the individual ingredients lose their particular qualities, and there is one color instead of many, which is in Latin, color est a pluribus unus. Not entirely green, since the milky morsels resist this, and not shining milk white, since it is varied with so many herbs. But some scholars believe that that phrase, a pluribus unum, one from several, is one of the earliest mottos of the United States, is derived from this passage in this particular, actually it's a poem with a recipe in it, a poem falsely attributed to Virgil, which describes how an old peasant blends the various ingredients in a dish prepared from cheese and garlic mixed with vegetables.
And here's one about hair. The Germanic custom of cutting and surrendering one's hair as a token of submission seems to have made blonde wigs fashionable among Roman women after the conquest of the Sagambri, a German tribe, in the Augustan period. Ovid recalls the embarrassment for all concerned when a girl he unexpectedly visited hurriedly put her wig on back to front. Faustina, the wife of the Emperor Marcus Aurelius, was said to have had a collection of several hundred wigs. Justinian's Digest mentions a tax on wigs imported from India, along with similar luxury taxes on eunuchs, lions, and leopards.
Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, our guest, Leonard Kaplan, will suggest some parallels between the Weimar Republic, Germany, between the two world wars, and the United States today. We'll see in which ways they converge and which ways they diverge next Sunday here on Wisconsin Public Radio.